It's Monday, February 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, two presidential primary winners help narrow the road to the White House. A Supreme Court vacancy sharpens the political divide.
There is a sort of legal and ethical argument to be made about encryption.
Protected data versus the fight against terrorism. Also ahead, silent musicians at this year's Grammy Awards. It's all on today's International Edition. Republican voters in the U.S. state of South Carolina and Democrats in Nevada made their choices for their respective parties' presidential nominee on Saturday. International Edition's Steve Norman speaks with VOA national correspondent Jim Malone about the two races as the presidential primary season continues.
Donald Trump continues his march toward the Republican nomination. He's won the last two contests, New Hampshire, now South Carolina. The upcoming Super Tuesday primaries, mostly in the southern states, that should help Donald Trump as well. So this was a big boost with a victory in South Carolina.
And Jim, what about the other Republican candidates? How did they do in South Carolina?
The other contenders at the moment in the Republican race look to be Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz. Rubio had a very strong surge here at the end in South Carolina, probably thanks to the help of the popular governor, Nikki Haley, and he is well suited to continue in the race, as is Ted Cruz, who's arguing he's the only true conservative left. Of course, we also have a casualty in the race now, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush dropping out. The field is shrinking, and it's starting to look more and more like a three-person race, Trump, Rubio, Cruz, with maybe Ohio Governor John Kasich on the outside hoping for some upcoming victories in Midwestern states.
And while the Republicans were voting in South Carolina, Democrats were voting in caucuses in the state of Nevada for their candidates. How did it go there?
Hillary Clinton had an important win in Nevada. Bernie Sanders was closing the gap in recent days. Bernie Sanders did demonstrate some ability to appeal to Hispanic voters. That's important moving forward. But Clinton was able to hold the line. That could be very important because now she is positioned to do well in the upcoming Democratic primary in South Carolina in a week's time, and also in several of the southern states coming up in Super Tuesday contests where African-American voters will play a very important role.
VOA national correspondent Jim Malone speaking with International Edition's Steve Norman. The one-time 17-candidate Republican field has now dwindled down to just five: Trump, Cruz, Rubio, Ohio Governor John Kasich, and former neurosurgeon Ben Carson. Voting is set for 24 other states by March 15th. Well, next we have our social media correspondent G. Abby Lee here in the studio to talk about the changing dynamics in the U.S. presidential race. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
So it looks like it's down to Trump and Clinton. What do you think?
Well, it definitely seems to be the case on Twitter. So let's check out the Republican winner first. Donald Trump at Real Donald Trump wrote this tweet after he won in South Carolina. What a great night. Thank you, South Carolina. A special place with truly amazing people. Love. Oh, how fluffy. He also thanked former Republican VP nominee Sarah Palin for her support before leaving for Atlanta and Nevada.
And now the crowded Republican race is getting streamlined a bit. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so like you said, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, or just Jeb with an exclamation mark, suspended his campaign this weekend. His Twitter page still shows Jeb2016.com website and describes himself as a candidate for POTUS. But the account shared a video clip of him announcing the decision with a short and sweet tweet. He wrote, "Thank you." Jim, I watched the clip, and I have to say that was the most engaging speech that he has given. I don't know why he couldn't do that earlier. He wasn't the most exciting candidate, really.
I'll have to check that out myself. Mm-hmm. Well, turning to the Democratic winner, Clinton, what did she tweet?
She wrote two tweets after a win in Nevada, and both are from her and not her staffers. So let's read just one of them. "To all my supporters out there, some may have doubted us, but we never doubted each other. This one is for you, Hillary in NV." Her rival Bernie Sanders tweeted he's very proud of the campaign they ran. He added, 5 weeks ago, we were 25 points behind, and we ended up in a very close election. As for Maryland, former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, yes, he's still in the running. he hasn't tweeted since February 1st, and even that was a retweet and not an original one. His handle is at Martin O'Malley, and that's all for me today, Jim.
Well, thanks very much for that update, G. You can follow her on Twitter, her handle, at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well, at VOA Stevenson, and our program's account is at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. The battle over a U.S. Supreme Court vacancy comes into sharper focus this week as the Senate gets back to work after a week-long recess and the White House continues to examine potential nominees. The partisan standoff over replacing Justice Antonin Scalia extends well beyond Washington, and it's been magnified and intensified by election year politics. Bells tolled Saturday at Washington's Roman Catholic Basilica as the nation paid final respects to Scalia, an arch-conservative jurist known for lively exchanges during oral arguments before the High Court and also colorful opinions written from the bench. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Chuck Grassley, both Republicans, penned an opinion piece in the Washington Post saying the next president, and not Barack Obama, should choose Scalia's replacement on the High Court. The White House, as you might expect, sharply disagreed. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman joins us to discuss.
Well, Jim, all the arguments that we've been hearing made by senators around the country in their various districts are all of a sudden going to be concentrated all in one building, all on the Senate floor. It should be a very entertaining week, just as the administration, I would imagine, is going over its list of possible candidates to replace Antonin Scalia.
The Republicans controlling both houses of Congress are essentially opposed to having President Obama make a selection for the Supreme Court at this point in time. Many are contending that, well, he should leave it to the next president.
That is the argument. And there seems to be two lines of thought coming from the Republicans. One is that President Obama should not be nominating anybody at all, and that any candidate that he does put forward is essentially dead on arrival as far as their nomination goes. But then there are some that are saying, well, of course, President Obama has the constitutional right to put a name forward if he wishes to, but the Senate also has the constitutional right to reject that person. And that at the very least, the Senate should go through the motions of holding a hearing or two or three, and then having some sort of vote. What is going to happen if a nomination is put forward and if there is a hearing and if it actually gets to the Senate floor, Ted Cruz, among other Republicans, have already said that they will filibuster, which means that 60 votes will be required to advance the nomination to a final simple majority vote. And that would mean that 14 Republicans would have to join with a unified Democratic caucus just to get to that final vote. And I have to tell you right now, I don't see those 14 votes materializing. They could materialize, but I don't see them at this particular moment.
I know the presidential candidates have also weighed in on this, and essentially along party lines.
Sure. And I should say that there's a bit of a chess game going on right now. I mean, if you are President Obama, do you put forth something of a centrist jurist, maybe someone who's already been approved by the Senate for a court position in a court of appeals or to the federal judiciary who's maybe already received bipartisan support? Or do you go for a sort of liberal firebrand, someone who will absolutely be rejected? But if you're President Obama and you think that whoever you send up there is going to be rejected, then maybe what you do is the politically clever thing and you nominate someone who will rally the progressive base of the Democratic Party and give Republicans fits. I mean, there really is something of a chess game going on here. And yes, indeed, Hillary Clinton has come to President Obama's rhetorical aid, saying that, of course, he has the right to nominate someone, and that really it's not a good thing for the court to be at a 4-4 deadlock with important cases coming up. There are four justices right now who were appointed by Democrats who are on the more progressive side of judicial thinking, and there are four who were appointed by Republicans who are very much on the conservative side of judicial thinking. What this sets up is the potential of deadlocked Supreme Court decisions, which means that the lower court decision that preceded the Supreme Court case would be the deciding decision. And that could have a huge amount of impact on all sorts of things, from the environment to abortion rights down the line, Jim.
Well, the strategy certainly is intriguing. And Michael Bowman, he's our VOA Senate correspondent and always our winner. Thanks so much for stopping by today, Michael.
Thank you, Jim.
In what is becoming one of the most important challenges to personal privacy, protection of proprietary technology, and methods used to combat terrorism, the U.S. Justice Department is stepping up its demands that Apple help in an investigation of a mass killing. The government filed a motion on Friday for the company to comply with a court order to unlock the iPhone used by one of the gunmen in last year's San Bernardino attack. Apple's chief, Tim Cook, is promising customers he will fight the order, saying that the software the investigators are seeking could be used to weaken the iPhone's security measures. Apple's lawyers are expected to file their response to the court order by the end of this week. And as this contentious struggle unfolds, VOA cyber correspondent Doug Bernard helps International Edition host Sarah Williams unlock the issues central to this case.
Doug, first, specifically, what did the judge rule?
Well, Sarah, the word was unlock, and I think that's really important to understand. So all Apple phones are now encrypted, but they're also locked, and the user basically can kind of set the parameters of that lock. Now, what the judge has basically ordered Apple to do is to deactivate a function of that phone that basically gives somebody 10 tries to unlock the phone. You can enter 10 passwords, and if by the end of the 10th password, you still have it wrong, all of the data on that phone is permanently erased. It's simply gone forever. So what the judge has ordered Apple to do is to create a bit of software to deactivate that particular phone, which would then allow, ideally, the FBI to decrypt the phone. What Apple is saying is not only that they won't do it, but they don't even think that they can do it.
That's fascinating. Apple, you think they can do anything.
Right. Well, now, so Apple CEO Tim Cook has come out. He's called the judge's ruling and the request unprecedented, chilling, and saying it essentially represents a security risk for all of Apple's customers. There are two things happening here. I think there is a sort of legal and ethical argument to be made about encryption. There is a technological debate as to whether backdoors are good ideas or not. But really, there's a financial discussion going on here, which is Apple has been using this encryption as a selling point. And so now if they have to kind of go back very publicly and say, oh, well, I guess we have to decrypt this phone and maybe that iPad and this other device, you know, customers, the fear is, really are going to leave Apple and go to Samsung or Google or any of the other companies out there offering encryption.
Well, you've reported before about FBI Director James Comey's warnings about the dangers of encryption.
Right.
What are some of the possible outcomes here?
Well, the words that James Comey uses are really kind of alarming. A phrase that he often has used over the past 2 years is that he says, quote, encryption threatens to take us to a very dark place. Now, dark, he says he means simply that light can't get to it, that law enforcement officials can't open up computers and phones to, you know, get potentially very valuable data, but it certainly carries with it a sort of emotional impact, the idea of ominous or threatening as well. So I think there's two things that can happen here. One, the legal process is going to work its way up. This was a district judge. There are many, many courts that it's going to go through. It will be appealed. That's a very long process. Now, while that's going on, I think simultaneously the FBI is very eager to try and reach some sort of agreement with the big manufacturers, Google, Apple, you know, those type, to create some sort of means or method to decrypt phones, but only in extreme circumstances. So far, the tech companies have said, nope, we're not going to do it, we can't do it, and we don't think we should do it. But so, you know, I think the FBI is going to use this lawsuit as legal pressure to perhaps create some kind of working agreement.
VOA cyber correspondent Doug Bernard with International Edition host Sarah Williams. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
The Grammy Award ceremony is, of course, one of the big annual highlights in music. Just as fun as it is to see the stars together at one time is to talk about who didn't show up. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald has shown up in our studio to fill us in on the most notable unseen performers of the Grammys.
We're going to talk about the stars who didn't come out at the 2016 Grammy Awards, Jim. First of all, Drake. His name was promoted during a Grammy ad that aired during the Super Bowl. However, apparently that was news to Drake because he went on Twitter and he wrote, "I'm not performing at the Grammy Awards, but hey, it's the thought that counts." So that was pretty cut and dried. Drake was not going to be at the Grammys, and that was that. Lauryn Hill. Things get a little more interesting here. Now, Lauren, of course, has a fairly extensive Grammy history. She released that fantastic album, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, that won her multiple Grammys in the 90s. Billboard reported that Lauren was to have duetted with The Weeknd on Monday night. However, she issued a statement saying that the Grammys announcement was premature. She had been doing concerts the previous weekend. Furthermore, no performance was ever confirmed. That's how Lauryn Hill explained her absence. The most interesting of them all is Rihanna, because she was actually there at the venue, the Staples Center, for rehearsals. She had confirmed that she was going to sing her new song, Kiss It Better. She turned up for rehearsals, and then E! News reported that doctors had ordered Rihanna to go on 48-hour vocal rest due to a case of bronchitis. Supposedly, she had been on antibiotics for 3 days, and it still hadn't knocked out the infection. However, 2 days earlier, on February 13th, Rihanna had sung for Lionel Richie at the Music Cares Person of the Year event, and a video exists of her singing Say You, Say Me, and, you know, she sounds pretty good. TMZ quotes unnamed sources as saying Rihanna was screaming and hysterical before she walked out of the rehearsals. Those sources also say Rihanna left with Lauryn Hill, so Lauryn apparently made it out there too, and that Rihanna wasn't happy at all about how the rehearsals went. So we have two obviously conflicting stories here. And then as far as other Grammy no-shows go, I suppose we could mention Kanye West, who tweeted that he was boycotting the Grammys until they gave him the Album of the Year award, which would have been impossible in any event because his new album was not released released during the eligibility period. So I think we can say that that was just Kanye blowing smoke because he's been all over Twitter lately.
Well, and then we would have had another Kanye-Taylor Swift incident.
Well, it was interesting to note that when Taylor Swift received Album of the Year, her second Album of the Year for 1989, she had a lot of other people on stage with her, and they were sort of forming a protective perimeter around her. I was live tweeting the Grammys, and I was saying, where is Kanye? Does anybody know where Kanye is? Because, of course, what famously happened back in 2009 at the MTV Awards when Kanye bum-rushed Taylor when she received her award. So there it is, some of the more notable no-shows at the 2016 Grammys.
Ray McDonald, our Top 20 Countdown host, and we thank you so much for joining us, Ray. Be sure to follow Ray on Twitter, by the way. What is that stream, Ray?
Ray on the Hits.
Follow him. Thanks so much for joining us.
You got it, Jim. Thanks.
Well, while Drake and Rihanna and Kanye West were no-shows, we're glad you showed up to listen to International Edition. You can find us at our website, voanews.com. We're also on Twitter, our handle, @VOA_IE. For Director Tracy Carter and Engineer Daryl Smith, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us. Come back again. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Officials from the U.S. government's Millennium Challenge Corporation, the MCC, visited Côte d'Ivoire this month to congratulate the government on its eligibility to develop an MCC Compact program. In December 2015, the MCC Board of Directors selected Côte d'Ivoire as compact eligible following several years of steady improvement by the government of Côte d'Ivoire on the MCC scorecard of policy indicators and a strong year-long partnership with MCC in developing an MCC threshold program for which Côte d'Ivoire became eligible in December 2014. Compacts are large, five-year investments that address a country's greatest constraints to economic growth, and threshold programs are smaller-scale investments designed for countries that don't yet qualify for a compact. The work done by Côte d'Ivoire on threshold program development will provide a solid foundation for an innovative compact program. On its most recent MCC scorecard, Côte d'Ivoire passed 13 out of 20 indicators, demonstrating remarkable improvement from passing only 5 indicators in 2013. Since its selection for eligibility for a threshold program, the government of Côte d'Ivoire has been a committed and collaborative partner. The government has remained highly engaged with indicator institutions, identifying reforms and providing data updates needed to improve its overall performance. U.S. Ambassador Terrence McCauley said, "The MCC Compact is a strong symbol of the United States' partnership with Côte d'Ivoire as it moves toward its goal of becoming an emerging economy by 2020. In its selection decision, MCC's board also expressed its support for Côte d'Ivoire to explore potential regional investments with neighboring countries. MCC recognizes that growth is more dependent than ever on economic integration. Countries can grow faster, create more jobs, and attract more investment when they are part of dynamic regional markets. The potential for a regional investment is great, given the critical role Côte d'Ivoire plays in the West Africa region." Côte d'Ivoire's transition from developing a threshold program to developing a compact program is a testament to the country's continued commitment to strong policy improvement and political stability, as evidenced by its recent presidential elections.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.